The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Shoot the defense, the best podcast in the world. We're at it.
I keep saying Henry's a forward.
Richie, who's the best striker you've played against?
Henry.
And the fact that we are now taking our country and put our country on the map of world soccer, being the first African nation, the third world nation in the whole world to win an Olympic gold medal in soccer, you know. It was unbelievable.
If you're going to take the time to go and get a pig head and break my locker open and wrap my clothes in it, and send in a different message to me.
I've had to protect my family from going out into the street because you'll have random people that just coming up and abusing them racially. Even some old school managers who are British, they still have the same racial undertones like the man in the street who they're trying to condemn.
Hello, welcome to another edition of Shoot the Defence. I'm your host, Stel. And my guest this evening is a gentleman who is the head coach or manager of the National League Leaders Barrow, also known as Barrow Salona. It's Ian Everett. Ian, welcome to the show, mate. How you doing?
How are you doing? You okay?
Yeah, all good, mate. All good, mate. We spoke about this prior to recording. How are you coping?
To be honest, I've been okay. The first couple of weeks, I was probably feeling a bit sorry for myself, but then realised, you know, you've got to try and turn this into a positive. So, been trying to, you know, think about how I can improve. I'm obviously, it's my first job. I'm new to management, so you know what I can be doing to improve myself with that, and then gives me an opportunity to concentrate on my own health again and try and get back fit. Management, when you retire. And you, people stop telling you what to eat and drink, and you can eat and drink what you want because you make the decisions. You tend to put weight on pretty quickly, so I've used this opportunity to try and get myself into some shape again.
Excellent. How's that going?
Yeah, it's good. I'm a couple of stone down. I'm in a good routine. I'm a creature of habit, to be fair, so I'm having a right go, but to be honest, I was only thinking this would last six weeks, 8 weeks, but it looks like we're going to be in this for the long haul, so I'm not sure I can maintain it for that long, to be honest.
Mate, I really need to get back into the gym. I'm one of these people where I struggle to train at home. I don't have the equipment, and on top of that, I don't have the... Well, I'm distracted while I'm at home, so it's very, very difficult to stay focused on, you know, squats and all that kind of stuff. I'd rather be in the gym, music on... Just throwing metal around, really. So
yeah, I get it. I understand it. I think it's that helps, doesn't it? Training with others, and seeing others. I just think, you know, getting out there and running at the minute gets me out of the house for an hour or so, and keeps my head clear and sane. To be honest,
yeah, absolutely. Because you know, mental health has become more and more crucial these days. We've heard about it in football. People such as Clark Carlisle, Danny Rose, they've all spoken. Openly about it, and I think we're slowly moving away from it to being a taboo subject. It's now becoming a reality to many people, and I just think right now it's a test to every single footballer. I mean, it's a test to everyone, don't get me wrong, but it's a test to footballers who are constantly in and out of the limelight, training every day, playing games. Now it's like you can't do anything, literally nothing.
No, I completely agree, and sometimes footballers, managers, they get put on this pedestal that, you know, people don't treat them and think of them as regular human beings. You know, we all bleed the same blood, we all have the same feelings, we all have the same problems, regardless of what industry you work in. And sometimes, you know, footballers, managers get forgotten. They get forgotten about, you know, that people that just have, you know, regular jobs or whatever will think of footballers like, what have they got to worry about? What stresses can they possibly have? You know, they've got the best job in the world, etc., etc. And you're all kind of put in that same bracket. However, you know, the human race doesn't work like that. Everyone has their own individual issues, their own individual problems. And mental health nowadays is very topical, and it's something we have to take really seriously.
No, I agree, mate. And the thing is, again, I agree with what you just said. You got people out there that say, oh, they're footballers, they've got X amount of money, they can do whatever they want, this and that. But when you're confined to four walls or you can't go anywhere, or you're not supposed to go anywhere, it doesn't matter how much money you've got. It doesn't matter because you can only entertain yourself to a certain capacity. At the end of the day, you know, prior to lockdown, you could go to a restaurant, you could go to a pub, you could see people, go to the cinema. It's a form of escapism, irrespective of your situation. And now we can't do any of that.
Yeah, and football in general, you know, you're used to that contact, that social contact every day. You're around large squads. You're around a lot of people, you know, and any footballer, manager, whoever will tell you, being a part of a dressing room and having that banter with the lads and the players and the staff, it's a huge part of it, you know, and it makes it really enjoyable. And that's kind of a bit like a tap just been switched off. You know, there's been no prior warning, really. It was just cut off one day and bang, you're at home and you're in self-isolation. And it's tough. It really is. And as I said, I hope... I've been in contact with my players and I've said to them if they're struggling, they can obviously pick up the phone to me. And obviously they need to keep themselves busy, keep their minds engaged, either watching footy, watching games, thinking about, you know, self-analysis, which is important. How can I improve? What do I need to do to get better? And use this time as a positive, really.
Well, one of my follow-up questions was going to be, do you contact your players and give them advice? But I, as you just said, you do. The thing is, your club, I take it, doesn't have like a sports therapist or someone at the club where they can pick up the phone and say, oh, I've got this and that problem, or like most big clubs. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, I mean, we obviously don't carry many staff. We have myself and Peter Atherton, my assistant. We have a goalkeeper coach, stroke analyst, who doubles up and does both sides. And then a physio and two physios and an S&C coach, really, that's it. In terms of that, you know, the kind of relationship I have with my players, they know that they can come to me with anything. First and foremost, they need treating as human beings, and given that respect, football is a secondary to how they're feeling and how their general lives are. So then I'd like to think they know they can pick up the phone to me with any sort of problem, and after that we obviously have... we brought in a club chaplain, really, that obviously it's another voice for players to hear, someone that can speak off the record, someone that, you know, when I was a player, sometimes you think managers will judge you and it'll have an effect on whether he picks you or whatever. So I understand sometimes players don't want to come to managers and staff, so they'd like to speak to someone outside of football, and that's the reason why we got him involved.
And how much of a help is someone like Peter Atherton? Because I remember him from his time at Coventry at Sheffield Wednesday. I believe he was caretaker manager at Bradford, and I think he was part of Wigan's youth academy or the on the coaching staff. So I presume he's had that kind of hands-on experience with younger players in the sense of mentoring and whatnot. Is he a big help for you?
Huge. And I'll say this to him, for me, of all the signings that I've made, he's been the best one. I grew up in Coventry. I'm a Coventry lad, and I had a season ticket at Coventry as a kid, so I used to watch Pete, believe it or not. And when I first got into management, I could have easily took someone I know or someone I played with, a friend, as an assistant, but I didn't think that would help me. I needed someone that I could bounce ideas off, someone that's willing to say, no, have you thought about it this way? But also have, you know, the same philosophy and a similar style to what I had. So I actually interviewed. Peter had just left Wigan, and as soon as we met, we hit it off, really. We have the same ideas about the game. We like to work and coach young players and improve them. Obviously, he had a fantastic playing career, but he's worked at Liverpool, he's worked at Wigan with young players, so he has, you know, a good relationship and a good foundation there with improving players. So yeah, it was a marriage made in heaven, really, and it's something that I'm really pleased with, and, you know, he's a big part of what we do.
Interesting you mention Coventry City. I was about to ask what you think of their current situation, because obviously they've had problems with Sisu. They're at St. Andrews last time I heard. I don't know if they're still there. I don't know. St. Andrews still, are they playing their games there? Are they back?
Yeah, they're still there. I mean, it's heartbreaking to have a club like that not have its own stadium. It's criminal, really. They had Highfield Road, obviously, yeah, and decided to sell that, which was the worst mistake they ever made, and then got into business with Errico, which just wasn't sustainable. They didn't own it, they weren't making any profit from it. And it was just a mess. And as I said, it's a fantastic club with great support. Coventry's quite a big city, so, you know, they need to get that situation sorted out. It's great what they're doing on the pitch at the minute. I love watching, you know, what they're doing and how they play, and keeping true to themselves with developing young players and playing young players. To be top of League One at the minute is great. So hopefully they get what they deserve and get promoted, and then get back to Coventry and find themselves a stadium.
Yeah, absolutely, mate. And you know, you mentioned that you were a season ticket holder. I don't think there's much age difference between us. We were born on the 19th of November, you and I.
Great.
Yeah, I've got a year on you. That's the only real difference. Age-wise, obviously, but yeah, you know, you'll remember that Coventry 90s squad where you got the likes of Vagrizovic and Mick Harford. I think that was when Bobby Gould was manager, and then afterwards Gordon Strachan. You know, it was a very, very good Coventry side, and I remember that great escape at White Hart Lane. Another fantastic achievement given the circumstances at the club, and it's such a shame to see them down there, because again, I remember Highfield Road. That was a very, very horrible place to go to. Pitch wasn't great either.
It was a tough place to go, and you know, there was one stage where, you know, they were one of the longest serving teams in the top division.
That's right.
They obviously won the FA Cup in 1987 with you know, John Sillett as manager and Big Cyril up front, and yeah, great team. And then it kind of evolved, like you say, into Strachan with Dion Dublin and Robbie Keane and people like that, Noel Whelan. Great teams, and it's just unfortunate, you know, that it just shows you no one's safe with what's happened to Leeds, with what's happened to Coventry. You can find yourself down the league. It even happened to Man City, you know, a few years back now. They ended up in League One. It can happen in football. There's no guarantees for success. You can quickly find yourself back-to-back relegations and struggling, you know, further down the pyramid.
So, two quick questions based on Coventry City. Did you base your game around any players there? Because I remember Phil Babb was breaking through around about the time when I really got into the Premier League. I mean, I've been following football since I can remember, 88, 89. But I remember, obviously, the early days of the Premier League when you see players coming through, like, as I said, Phil Babbs, and you had people like Roy Wegerle there and all that.
Yeah, do you know what? No, I mean, I left, and you know, everybody, I had a lot of friends in Coventry. I had great friends that ended up, you know, Gary McSheffrey, for instance, I grew up with, and he ended up having a great career. And,
yeah, that's right.
And everyone was saying, go and play for Coventry, go and play for Coventry. But I went to Derby and made a decision to get away from my friends, really, at 11 years old, and concentrate on football. And luckily for me, I had a fantastic coach who is now, you know, assistant manager at Arsenal. He's been at England, Man United, and Steve Brown. He coached me from 11 until 21, and he gave me a great, you know, format of how to play the game, really technical. Even though I was a big lad, I was always a technical footballer. You know, I kind of started as a central midfield player and moved back and ended up being a centre-half. But to have him, Steve McLaren, but then have like old school managers like Jim Smith, who gave you those values, you know, which has really served me well, because I've kind of played through a transition of an era, really. The old school values of pinning people up against the wall and shouting, screaming, throwing teacups, the old Fergie hairdryer treatment, that's kind of moved away now. And it's more tactical, technical, how you speak to players. You have to respect them, because they don't take criticism very well nowadays, especially the millennials, so to speak. So
yeah.
I was very fortunate to kind of have those old school values, but also, you know, have modern methods and understand how the modern game's played and how you need to treat characters.
But weren't you at Derby from like the age of 10? So it's not as if like you were there from, you know, early teens and whatnot. You were there right from day dot.
Yeah, I was there from, like you say, 10 till 21, 22, ended up playing, you know, quite a few games in the first team, played in the Premier League at 17. Yeah, if Derby Derby's a fantastic football club, great football club, and again, with what happened to them, you know, we end up getting relegated under John Gregory. Then George Burley took over and things changed, and then you quickly find yourself, you know, released. And when you're released and out of contract, as many players will find out this summer, it's difficult to get football clubs. There's so much competition, and the finances are tight, and it was tough. I ended up signing for Chesterfield for 2 years, and it was kind of make or break, really. It was, you know, I'd always had this silver spoon. I had a lot young, you know, I was a very young player to play in the Premier League, and sometimes looking back in hindsight, I had too much too young, you know, and I didn't respect it enough. I thought I was in a bubble that would never burst, and then when my bubble got burst by George Burley and you end up getting released, you think you're too good for Chesterfields, you know, you do. I genuinely thought that. Yeah, you know, I was saying to myself, hang on, I played in the Premier League 2 or 3 years ago, I'm 21 years old, I shouldn't be at Chesterfield. But you have to figure that out pretty quickly, and it's either, like I said, sink or swim. You find yourself out of the game, or you're ready to kick on again. Lucky for me, I had Roy McFarland as manager, who again was a fantastic player, who saw something in me, developed me into a proper centre-half, taught me so much, but also gave me the captaincy at a young age, gave me some responsibility. That responsibility I needed at the time. I needed someone to really get a hold of me and say, look, you need to concentrate now, you need to focus on your football, otherwise you could easily go the other way. And, you know, as I said, that was a massive help to me.
Mm. Great stuff. Well, look, let's go quickly back to your debut for the club. 1-1 draw against Ipswich Town, I believe. You came on for Thordica Johnson, if I am correct, if my research is. Now, you were in the team with the likes of Stefano Iranio and Georgie Kinkladze. What were they like on and off the pitch?
Stefano Iranio, you know, he was a European Cup winner. He's come from AC Milan, but he was a wonderful guy. Really kind, soft-spoken, genuine. Looked after himself so well. He was the first into training and the last out, and kind of you understood, as I said, going back to the era sort of thing, there were still players that were happy to be out drinking nights out. There was still a drinking culture, eating the wrong foods, you know. McDonald's sponsored the Premier League at the time. Yeah, I can remember all the players used to get McDonald's gold cards, which you could basically get what you wanted from McDonald's for free. And, you know, modern day, that would be unheard of, because the way the game's changed with nutrition and stuff. So yeah, Stefano was a fantastic player to learn from. Georgie was so talented, you know. You can kind of compare him to Messi, but he's obviously not in the same bracket as Messi, but very similar in terms of very small, all left footed. If you can remember that goal he scored for Man City where he beat eight players. What a goal. He was capable of that sort of thing. But he was like, you know, didn't take the game seriously enough and probably didn't get the most out of how talented he was, to be honest. He was, you know, always happy to joke about. And there was a mixture of that, you know. There was obviously Paolo Wanchops, who was a character and a joker. But then you had like Stefano, who came in, Francesco Baiano, Igor Stimac, these big characters that would really carry themselves well, you know, and some people you can learn from.
That's right. And if I remember correctly, Kinkladze had come from a spell at Ajax, because he left City and then he went to Ajax for a couple of years. Didn't really do too well in the Eredivisie, but then he came to Derby County on loan and then made the move permanent. And he was one of the best players I've seen in the 90s in the Premier League. Very, very underrated. And perhaps if he was at a bigger club, okay, City are a big club, but if it was at United or a Liverpool, he probably would have done much better. But
yeah, I agree. I think if he'd have just dedicated himself to the game more, he would have done better. But such a talented player, one of the most talented players I've ever played with.
So do you think that that tenure at Ajax kind of popped his bubble, so to speak?
I don't know. Georgie, you know, his background was obviously Georgian. And really, real poverty, you know, grew up around poverty and had nothing. And then all of a sudden, when you're thrust into the limelight and you get given so much money and you get so much fame, there isn't that education for players out there. Something I harp on about all the time. Now, most of us are from, you know, good solid working class backgrounds. You know, we haven't really grown up with anything. And when you get given that spotlight and fame at 17, 18, 19 and given money and time on your hands, it's a recipe for disaster. And Georgie was probably one of those that suffered because of that. As I said, in Georgia, he came from poverty, he came from nothing, and all of a sudden he's a multi-million pound player getting paid millions of pounds. And yeah, I mean, I think off the pitch probably affected how good he was on the pitch, but he was still such a talented player.
Brilliant. And one more thing, well, actually two quick things. Rory Delap, was he as good as throwing the ball as he was at Stoke?
To be honest, we didn't know he had a long throw. It's madness. Rory, I can remember when Rory came from Carlisle. And yeah, just a great guy. Fantastic lad. Really funny. Not the brightest, to be fair, to Rory. Not the brightest. Or Danny Higginbottom. Danny wasn't the brightest. Everyone used to get onto Danny about how thick he was, but
he's a good pundit, though. He's a very good pundit, I must admit.
Oh, he's a great pundit, and he's developed so much, and, you know, he's one of the best out there in terms of punditry now, which is great. It's great to see. But, yeah, at the time, Derby had a lot of good young players coming through, but also had signed some good young players as well, with the likes of Rory and Danny Higginbottom. If only we'd have known Rory could throw at Miles, then we'd have probably utilised that a bit more than what we did.
Yeah, brilliant. And the final one, Taribo West, was he there at the time?
Yeah, Taribo was one of the strangest characters I've ever met. Really strange character. Just didn't know what you were going to get. He was like a bag of rebels, honestly. One minute you get the coffee Taribo, who don't want to speak to anyone, and he's aggressive and angry. And the next you get the Malteser or the minstrel, you know, and he was a pleasure to be around. So funny, laughing and joking. Was a great player, really good defender. You know, 1v1, one of the best I've seen in terms of, you know, you couldn't get past him. But a real character, you know, that had a great career. You know, he played for Inter Milan and people like that. So, yeah, some great names. Fabrizio Ravanelli as well. Again, big name, huge name. Been at Juve, Middlesbrough. Big character, but good guy, you know. And Derby had some exceptional talent back then.
Yeah, Mikael Beck was there, Branko Strupar.
Yeah.
Dion Burton, yeah. He was another fantastic forward, he was.
Yeah, Dean Sturridge. Yeah, the list goes on, really. Good players.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously, Mark Puma was a fantastic goalkeeper, ended up at Arsenal. So, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, well, let's do a little bit of a leapfrog here and talk about your move to QPR. No, sorry, Northampton. What am I talking about? You went on loan to Northampton. And again, you were surrounded with players that had a lot of experience. Marco Gabbiadini, Jamie Forrester, Paul McGregor, who's now known as Honey, and they punk band, I believe. The likes of Daryl Burgess and Ian Frayne. So, what was it like going to Northampton? They're not too far from Derby, anyway.
Yeah, so I literally just made my debut in the Premier League, and then the manager felt like I needed to get some more experience, some men's football under my belt. So, I decided to go to Northampton. Obviously, from Coventry, it's very close, so it kind of fitted quite nice. But went there for 3 months, enjoyed my time. You know, some of it is in my memory for the wrong reasons. I can remember playing in a Carling Cup match at night against Middlesbrough away, and we were in the hotel when September the 11th happened, and I still remember like it was yesterday. But yeah, it gave me that opportunity to step down to League One, but also to get used to men's football, you know, day in, day out, game on game, you know, Tuesday, Saturday. It's physically tough for young players sometimes, but it kind of toughened me up a bit, and by the time I went back, I was ready to kick on again.
Brilliant. And then a move to QPR happened further down the line. Tell me about this one, because again, more experienced players, Paul Furlong, Kevin Gallen, Steve Lomas.
Yeah, strange. It was a strange move. I'd done really well at Chesterfield, and It was the time of the. Do you remember the Coca-Cola winner player pick a player where?
They get a certain amount of money where they could.
And Mark McGee phoned me saying that they wanted to spend that money on me. But you know, weird. I was on holiday, and when all this was kicking off, and the chairman of QPR at the time, Gianni Palladini, was Fabrizio Ravanelli's agent at Derby. So I already knew Gianni. And Gianni phoned me saying, look, we've watched you, we really want you to sign, you know, where are you, we want to do the deal now. I was like, well, I'm in Mallorca. He's like, right, we're jumping on the next flight. So the chair, Palladini, flew out with a couple of other guys and another advisor, and the deal was done. So then when obviously Mark McGee rang, it was too late, and Leicester rang as well. And there was some regrets with that in hindsight, really. But Ian Holloway was the manager at the time. And it turned out that I think the chairman had signed me rather than him.
Right.
When I got there, a young player in London on his own, I just wasn't ready for. I wasn't mature enough to live in London on my own and be focused on my job at hand. And plus, I didn't get off to the best starts. And the team was very direct. It was 4-4-2, strong, aggressive, as you said, experienced. And it kind of wasn't me. It was difficult. Then Ollie got the sack, Gary Waddock took over, I played some games for him, and it was better, but I just couldn't settle. And then Blackpool loan opportunity came along with Simon Grayson, and he ended up going there, and then the rest was history, really. I had, you know, 8 fantastic years there.
So tell me something, you've moved down to London, I presume. Was it a cultural thing that you struggled to kind of get used to life in London, or was it just the club in general that made it difficult for you?
I think a mixture of the two, if I'm being brutally honest. London is obviously it's an amazing city, and I love going to London, even now. But when you live there, it's completely different.
Yep.
When you dip in and out, you enjoy it far more than when you live there, and it can really, not just the amount of travelling and the amount of time you spend in cars and stuff, especially when you're travelling Shepherd's Bush, where Loftus Road is, but also, you know, day to day, there's always something happening and something going on. As I said, a young player, there's lots of things that you can lose focus with, you know, whether that's going to bars, nightclubs, going out shopping or whatever else. I was just not mature enough to be able to be on my own down there and not go into that side of things, really. And it kind of took my focus away from football. So that's why, you know, it didn't really work out for me, to be honest. It's probably my own fault. But also the club was getting so political. Like, obviously, Palladini was in charge. You know, there'd be times we'd turn up to the training ground, we'd be locked out because the bill hasn't been paid. And then the back end of that was like Briatore, and then you've got supermodels turning up, Naomi Campbell, whatever else, you know, in the players' lounge. It was just crazy, crazy times, really. You look back at it now and smile, but massive learning curve.
Well, I can imagine, because I always seem to remember QPR as a very family-oriented club. I've had the likes of Paul Parker on the show, Trevor Chalice. We spoke about Ray Wilkins the other week, and the vibe I get is that QPR has always been, as I said, very family focused. All the players are together. It's a unit. But it just appears that during that regime or that era, it was completely the opposite. Granted, you had the players that had been there from day dot, like your Paul Furlongs, your Kevin Gallons. But in terms of a hierarchy, it appears that it was at sixes and sevens, really.
Yeah, it just started to change. It just started to really change. As you said, QPR is proper family club, proper going back to like working class family club, you know, people in Shepherd's Bush going to see the ARs and supporting them, and really intimidating atmosphere at Loftus Road, and they really get behind the lads. But when you start to turn up and the entrance reception all been marbled out, and you've got Naomi Campbell and Kate Moss and supermodels with Briatore, who's, you know, a bit of a showman, you know, doing all this, it just detracts from what the actual club stood for, you know. And it was tough to deal with. And as you said, you can really really easily, especially as a young player, get caught up in all the lights and forget about the job that you're there to do.
Yeah. I mean, it's a shame because I think Dean Sturridge was there at the time, if I remember correctly, and you guys were at Derby together, so I'd have thought that you'd been easier for you to settle and having a former teammate there, but sometimes it just doesn't work out like that, does it?
Yeah, well, Studge, to be fair, Studge used to travel, you know, he was a Birmingham lad, so he'd drive from Birmingham to, you know, we used to train at Heathrow, we took on Chelsea's training ground, so...
So it's not was it the college that you were training at? Is it the college grounds that you guys were training on?
No, do you know, I can't remember what it was called, but it was Chelsea's before they moved to Cobham.
Right, okay.
It's literally right on Heathrow's runway.
Right by the airport, yeah.
Yeah, right by the airport. And yeah, so Studge used to travel, so it probably would have helped me if he'd have been down there, really. But as I said, I was on my own, I was a young lad, and you get caught up in the lights of London without... When I wasn't ready, you know, maturity-wise, I wasn't there yet to be able to switch on and focus on my day-to-day job. And as I said, it was my fault, but the actual club and the politics of it and how it was changing didn't really help with that.
Mm. Fair enough. Whereabouts did you live, by the way?
I started off in Chiswick.
Chiswick, okay.
Just on the high street there, and then I moved to Marlow on Thames, which is a beautiful place. Fantastic place. Really expensive, but great place to live.
Brilliant. Okay, so you moved to Blackpool, and wow, where do I begin with this one? Because a bit of a tricky season, wasn't it, your first one?
It was like rags to riches, really. Mm. They just survived last game of the season, or a couple of games to go the season before. Yeah. Simon Grayson had just retired and had took over, and it was his first job as a manager. They started to get this investment from a guy in Latvia called Valery Belakon, and we'd signed 12 players that summer, and we got off to a really bad start. I think we were bottom of the league after 6 games. Mm. And we were all thinking, what's going on here? But then all of a sudden things just clicked. The squad clicked, the team spirit clicked, the way we were playing clicked, and we just went on an amazing run. You know, the last 10 games of the season we won all 10, culminating in the playoff final against Yeovil, which we won comfortably. A great season and a great start to how things, you know, were progressing there, really.
Mm. So, you know, as I said, you were promoted through the playoffs. Obviously, it's a grueling competition, isn't it, having to go through that. From a psychological perspective, what did it do for the club? Well, in terms of building up the confidence for the following season, shall I say?
Yeah, huge, really. Huge for the club. And it started to really build some momentum, you know. When you're on a winning streak and you were seen as underdogs, and we had the rookie manager, loads of unknown players, and then all of a sudden you're winning, as I said, 10 on the spin. The belief it gives you, and Blackpool as a town and a community changed. All of a sudden it was... We were riding high, you know. We were on that big one, that big roller coaster, you know. We were all riding it, and it was a great feeling. And as I said, to finish it off at Wembley was brilliant, brilliant.
Mm. And the fact that you guys got promoted over Nottingham Forest must have been a very pleasing situation for you.
Yeah, well, we actually did that twice. Sorry to Forest fans, obviously. We did it in League One, but we did it in the Championship as well when we beat them in the semis. So yeah, I mean... Forest, a massive football club, but we were just their bogey team. We just had it over them.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, Yeovil beat Forest in the playoff semi-final, didn't they? They beat them 5-2 in the second leg, and that was a really, really entertaining game. So when you faced them,
I think Forest were 2-0 up, weren't they, after the first leg? And we were thinking, oh, we're going to be playing Forest here, but no, it was that Yeovil game was, you know, a classic, really, probably an EFL classic. Yeah. The way it went down, crazy.
Marcus Stewart was on fire that night, and you faced him in the final, and he didn't get a kick, did he?
No, we were very good. We were just, by that time, we were just in the zone, you know, and we were beating everybody. We beat Swansea really comfortably, I think 6-2 or 6-3 last game of the season. Then we beat Oldham home and away in the first playoff games, and then just going to Yeovil, yeah, we just dominated from start to finish, really. And was a good performance, and as I said, great to get the win and win at Wembley, at the new Wembley as well. I think it was only the second game there, so great to experience that.
Mm, there you go. Fast forward a few more years, you just about get into the playoffs.
Yeah.
First of all, before we talk about that playoff campaign, what was it like on that final day? I know you just about scraped through by a point ahead of Swansea. So what was that like? I think you drew against Bristol City at home, didn't you?
Again, like it was so strange because Ollie came in the summer and he was completely different to what I knew at QPR. You know, I was thinking we're going to be direct, physical, but no, he changed and he wanted to play attractive, expansive, attacking football, you know, that suited me so much better. And he just came in and more than anything else just changed our mentality and said, you know, stop being happy with surviving in the Championship. You need to set your sights higher. You need to believe in yourselves more. And we got better as the season went on. And then we were getting within touching distance of the playoffs and not quite getting in. And then we played Peterborough second to last game of the season away, and we won 1-0, and it got us into that sixth spot. And then all of a sudden we had to match or better Swansea's result last game of the season against Bristol City. We ended up going behind 1-0 in that game, and Swansea were drawing 0-0 at home against a team that I think were down the bottom, so we thought they'd be guaranteed to win. And then Brett Ormerod equalised. We were drawing and then we were hanging on and waiting for Swansea, and I think Lee Trundle had a goal disallowed with a couple of minutes to go for offside. And yeah, eventually we were in the playoffs, and it was crazy really. We'd achieved that, but then we actually believed that we could go on and win it.
Well, you did.
Yeah.
You went on to win the playoffs. But before we talk about that, mate, tell me about the squad cohesion there, because when you think about the players that were in that squad at the time when you got promoted, you had the likes of DJ Campbell that had a fantastic season, Gary Taylor Fletcher, friend of the show, Charlie Adam, even Nards was there, wasn't he?
Yeah. Again, the squad was amazing because we were all on a different journey. You know, Charlie had come down from Scotland. Some of us had been in, you know, League One teams and not really played so much in the Championship. Some of us had obviously, like me, had played in the Premier League as a young lad and had to go back down to get back up again. And it was like a team of misfits, really. But we just bonded, and it's hard to explain it. The team spirit was like nothing I experienced before or after. We were just best mates, and we still are. We still have a WhatsApp group together, and we speak daily. Fantastic. And the gaffer's even in that. So it just shows you about the bond we had, and it just shows you that team spirit is underestimated, because when you get a team that really want to fight and go that extra mile for each other, you can achieve special things.
Brilliant. And when you look at that squad and you look at the names, as I mentioned before, your Brett Ormerods, all these players that have been there and done it. It was a pretty small squad, though, wasn't it, for a 46-game standard season?
It was very small, and we got very lucky with injuries, and I don't think any of us really suffered with any injuries that season. We kept everyone fit and healthy, and we signed Seamus Coleman on loan.
That's right.
For the last 3 months of the season, and he improved us. And all of a sudden, yeah, again, we just hit form at the right time, and we played Forest in the semis again, and Forest had finished, I think, third that season, and they'd only lost one game at home all season, and that was to us. We'd done the double over, and we just fancied it. You know, everyone thought Forest were going to win easily and win the whole playoffs easily, but we won the first leg after going behind 2-1. And I can remember Billy Davis after the game rubbing his hands together saying, "Job done, lads, job done. You know, we're going to win the second leg and that's it, it's job done." Telling all the press that as well. And it just fired us up. It really just fired us up. And then the second game was, for me, probably the best game I've ever played in. And it was on Sky last night, funny enough. And all the lads were talking on the group chat about what a fantastic game it was. And unbelievable atmosphere, incredible atmosphere. Mm-hmm. I still remember Mullagh Kintyre being, you know, the way sung before the game, so loud. And Rob Earnshaw scores early on and ties it up, but then we ended up winning 4-3, I think, on the night. DJ got a hat-trick. and after the game, everyone's shouting, "Billy, job done." You know, banging the changing room walls, walking in, just great times, great memories.
Well, I think it just shows the camaraderie and belief you guys had in each other. When you take into consideration, you fell behind early, as you said, you pulled it level, then you went 2-1 down a few minutes into the second, about 10-15 minutes into the second half, and then again you pull it level, and then two more goals, two in the space of, well, I think you scored three in like 7 minutes.
Yeah. It was just, that comes down to mentality and what Ollie put in us, really. We were just relentless with what we did. You know, we didn't get affected by teams scoring against us. Teams were allowed to score against us, but we just had a belief that we could go up the other end and score more than the opposition. And it was that simple, you know. We went behind twice in the final against Cardiff, and we came back and won 3-2. It's just what was in us. We just had that such strong belief and character that comes from that team spirit, that we could overcome anything. And yeah, a great game against Forest, then we go and win the final, and then we all went to Vegas on one of the lads' stag news, but also a celebration like a couple of days after the final, and we walk into this nightclub, and who's there? Wes Morgan and all the Forest boys. And again, we started singing and chanting. Great memories, brilliant times.
Fantastic. All right, now let's move on to that Premier League season, because, boy, that was some season, wasn't it? I know you guys got relegated, but you sure gave it a go. I remember you guys being ahead against United at home and then losing.
We were ahead against United both games.
Yeah.
Do you know what? I don't have many regrets in my career, but for us to be relegated that season was a travesty, really. We did so well, you know. We got promoted on a £3 million budget, which is unheard of. It'll never be done again. There's nobody that will ever get to the Premier League on a £3 million budget ever again. And we did that. And we kept the nucleus of the same team. We had 27 points, I think, on New Year's Day. We beat Liverpool home and away. But our keeper got injured, Matt Gilkes, and he had a bad injury for 3 or 4 months. And I remember at the time there was big rumours about us going for Shea Given, but he was going to cost us a hell of a lot of money just on loan, because he wasn't playing at the time. And the chairman kind of took a gamble and said, "I think we're going to be all right anyway, so we'll go for someone small." And we ended up signing the Ghana keeper called Richard Kingson,
yeah,
who was 5'6", just not ready for Premier League football. And we went on a horrendous run. A really bad run, and we ended up, you know, getting sucked into it. We were beating Tottenham, I think, second or third to last game of the season, 1-0 away, which would have kept us up, and Defoe scored from 35 yards in the last second, and then you're on 39 points, and we weren't in the drop zone, but we knew that Wigan and others had other games that they could win, and we had Man United away, we're champions. And you know, the writing was on the wall, but we gave it a good go there. We went 1-0 down early, but then got ourselves 2-1 up, and then we ended up losing the game 4-2. But to get 39 points and be relegated, I don't think, you know, that amount would have stayed up 9 times out of 10. I think it would have stayed up in every season since we've got relegated. So we were really unlucky, sometimes a bit naive. We were winning games 2-0 away from home, and we had that attitude, that gung-ho attitude, where we could have just seen the game out, but we didn't. We kept on going for the jugular, and it cost us points, and that probably found us out in the end.
Well, the thing is, you had a fantastic season, you personally, and I think it was very unfair that a lot of people gave you stick for that own goal against United, because effectively a season is won and lost over 38 games. It isn't just one game at the end of the day.
Yeah, it was tough because I played in every. I was the only player to have played in every game that season, and I got Player of the Year. I won Player of the Year, and yeah, I mean, there was no one more hurt than me. And these things can happen, you know. Own goals happen, especially when you're defending and you're putting your body on the line and you're against a team like Man United. But it hurt me. Yeah, it hurt me that it happened on that day, and it hurt me that we ended up being relegated. But yeah, we got over it pretty quickly, and we came back again the following season, had a great season in the Championship, and got beat in the last minute of the playoff final. But yeah, great times, great memories.
So in closing, do you think it was the lack of Premier League experience throughout the whole squad is the reason you guys didn't stay up? Because again, when you look here, it wasn't a very experienced squad. I know Cathcart came in, but he was young. You had Marlon Harewood came in, Luke Varney as well. I think DJ Campbell obviously was already there. But, you know, it did seem like a very inexperienced Premier League squad.
I don't think it was the experience. I just think it was the way we played. Every neutral's second team. Everyone loved to watch us play. You know, we were carefree, gung-ho. And as I said, we were 2-0 up at Blackburn, 2-0 up at Bolton, when we could have just shut up shop and sat off and you know, kept a clean sheet or, you know, just saw the game out. But the way we played, we just wanted to go and score 3, 4, 5, and we ended up drawing those games 2-2, and there's other occasions as well. And you just think, do you know what, that one more point would have kept us up. And you look back at it and think, do you know what, we probably, you know, we caused our own downfall there with the way we played and how we attacked, when we could have really been a bit less naive and just saw it out. But that wasn't us, and that's not the way the manager set us up to play.
Absolutely. Well, look, you've gone from Blackpool, which, you know, a club that was working with a budget. You're now the head coach of Barrow. And right now, it's a very difficult situation for you guys. Now, I know, I think about, 1972, I think Barrow finished third bottom from Division 4, 8 points ahead of Crewe. But then I think the last four bottom clubs had to apply for re-election or something along those lines, and Barrow lost the vote, so they weren't able to remain. So when you're in a situation whereby, you know, your club, I think your average wage is what, $7,750 a week. Being in the Football League would earn you, what, a minimum of $1,900,000 a year. So you being in this current situation, not knowing where you guys are, it must really hurt you, not just psychologically, but also financially.
Huge. And it's so ironic that you just mentioned that, you know, we were voted out of the league 48 years ago and we didn't finish in the relegation spots, and now we could end up going back into the league with another vote. It's, you couldn't make it up, really. You couldn't write it. It's huge for the, we haven't been close since. As I said, this is my first job in management. We've created and done some brilliant things, and this year's kind of been that perfect storm where it's all come together. You know, we've done great on the pitch, we've reconnected with the fan base, we've got that missed generation of fans back that, you know, felt like they've been hard done to with that vote and being kicked out of the Football League. We're seeing young kids wearing Barrow shirts again instead of United and Liverpool shirts. So for the club, it's huge. You know, we're talking about 80 grand from the National League or potentially 1.2 million from the EFL. So it's massive. It's massive for everybody. And as I said, I'm gutted in many ways because I really thought that we would have got over the line and we would have won the league. We've been top for 5 months. We've been the best team. And you know yourself, winning things and winning championships and titles in football clubs isn't easy. Isn't easy at all, and we've kind of missed out on seeing full houses and lifting trophies and having the celebrations after. So that's left a kind of bittersweet taste in our mouth, but hopefully we'll get what I believe is the right result and we'll end up being promoted into League Two.
Just out of curiosity, if the Premier League decide to hand Liverpool the title and you guys don't get your way, what can you do about it? Because, I mean, surely them giving Liverpool the title sets a precedent for the rest of the country.
Yeah, I think so. And I think initially everybody was worried about null and void. But if you look across world football now, any professional league, even if they've finished early, it hasn't been void in an expunge like steps 3 to 7. It's, you know, for instance, you know, Ajax and the other team have been awarded Champions League spots. Paris Saint-Germain have been awarded the French League. I just think there'll be that much, you know, that many legal challenges to do that. I just can't see it happening. I think we've gone away from that now. I genuinely just think we're waiting for the dominoes to fall in line. So the Premier League will be first when they make a decision. Then the EFL will obviously follow up with theirs. And then we're on the back of that. So I think we're basically just waiting for the big fish to make their call, the Premier League. they're obviously have an effect on the Championship and the AFL, and then obviously we'll be in the last part of that. But I'm confident, without being complacent, that, you know, we'll end up being okay.
Well, see, this is it. You mentioned the Dutch league being cancelled and then awarding the European places, but I've got contact at Utrecht and they're in a cup final against Feyenoord. Now, a win for them would effectively take them into the Europa League, which means more money. Now, they're taking the Dutch to court, the Dutch KNVB, they're taking them to court over this situation because they don't want the season to be cancelled as a result of this, you know? So, I think that, again, as you said, it's a domino effect. So, once one decision is made, other teams are going to, other nations are going to follow suit. But then there's always going to be little obstacles whereby there'll be little roads, avenues bearing off. And I think that right now, even if you guys don't get the decision that you guys deserve, because let's be real, you've been top for what, 5 months?
Yeah.
It's not as if it's neck and neck. You're walking away like Craig David. So it's come to the point where, in reality, you guys deserve to be promoted. It's that simple. And let's be 100% honest. I've heard these stories about Man United and Liverpool potentially losing out on 90 million or 100 million if the season is cancelled. For crying out loud, 90 million is a huge amount of money, but for you guys, 1 million is pretty much the same in that respect, you know?
I've said that arguably we've got more to lose than them, you know? And that's a fact.
Well, you've got your existence. Your existence is on the line, isn't it? Let's be real.
100%. 100%. And as I said, the most important thing for me is that we're not talking about having 20 or 30 games left here. We're talking about, in some cases, 7 games, which we've played over 80% of the season, you know. If we're awarding, say, students grades and exam marks on what they've achieved so far in their school year, then surely it has to apply to football as well. You can't just cancel the league and say, whatever you've done, you know, all these fans that have paid money to come and watch, you know, my striker who scored 20-odd goals, you know, that's all forgotten and cancelled. Forget last season, we'll just wait for next. It doesn't work like that. You know, you deserve, and you are where you are right now. It's that simple, you know. We deserve to be where we are. We've been the best team this season. And unfortunately, and this is the downside of football, that everybody has self-interest. Everyone has that self-preservation, their own agenda, you know. And I think if you asked people honestly, away from all of this, you'd always say you want teams and people in general life to be awarded and rewarded for good performance. You don't want it the other way around. And I think by voiding leagues or not having promotions or whatever, all you're doing is rewarding the teams at the bottom and not the top.
Hypothetically speaking here, because I don't know the current situation, obviously you know more than I do in the legalities and all that. What if they turn around and said to you, right, we're going to start the season, say, for example, in September, when everything's all safe and well, fingers crossed, but you have to face the side that you're potentially replacing in a two-legged affair. Would you guys accept that? Or would you be like, well, you know, we would,
but obviously, again, if we're not completing the season, then how can we have more fixtures? You know, that would be my point. Like, if we're going to play games, let's finish the season off. You know, we haven't asked the season to be finished. It was taken away from us. It just so happens that we're top when it has finished. You know, we didn't vote for that. The league voted for that. And just because we're top, why should we be punished? And there's also the situation where the AFL is a team short with the demise of Berry, obviously.
Yeah.
So, obviously, naturally, we'd be that replacement. They're going to need to replace them. So, you know, as I said, things are looking promising in our favour. I'm confident rather than complacent, really.
Oh, that's good. That's good because, you know, you've got a fantastic team there, and at the end of the day, very similar to Blackpool in the sense that you've got a very small budget and you're achieving something absolutely phenomenal there, and more power to you guys, honestly.
No, I appreciate it, and as I said, it's nice to have people call us Barcelona and stuff like that. You know, when you get that said about your team, you know, you glow with pride, really, and I'm very proud of what the lads have achieved this season.
Fantastic. Ian, it's been great having you on the show, mate. Honestly, can't thank you enough for your time. You've given us, what, close to an hour. It's incredible. And your memories are absolutely fantastic. And one more thing before I let you go, I have to put you on the spot here, like I haven't done already enough on this show. If I was to ask you the best 11 you faced 11 footballers from goalkeeper to striker. Could you name them?
So, you know, I'd probably have to go with Van der Sar in goal, Vidic and Ferdinand, fullbacks. You'd probably have to look at Gary Neville for what he's done, and then you're looking at Ashley Cole at Chelsea. Midfielders, well, sport for choice really, Scholes, Fabregas, Yaya Toure, David Silva, names could go on. And then I always get asked about who the best player was that you played against, and as a defender, I always say Didier Drogba. You know, Didier Drogba in his prime was such a handful. He could do everything, you know. He could run, he was technical, he was powerful, he smelled amazing. You know, honestly, he was such a good player. And you know, that Chelsea team was a very good team, but he stood out and was a proper handful to play against. So I'd say that he was probably the best. And then to partner him, again, he spoke for choice, Tevez, Rooney, Van Persie, loads and loads of names, really.
The thing is, Ian, I hear all these stories about, you know, Paul Scholes and Lampard and Gerrard. What about Yaya Toure?
I forgot about Gerrard. It's because we beat Liverpool home and away, you see. I didn't count him. But again, Yaya had just come over, and he was so powerful, such a good player. And if you look at Man City and what they did and how they won the Premier League, he was a huge part of that. He doesn't really get mentioned in the same breath as Scholes and Gerrard, Lampard, but he should, because he was a top player.
So, all right, so you mentioned Van der Sar, fantastic goalkeeper. You mentioned Vidic and Rio. Ashley Cole as a left-back. I remember, again, it was always him and Patrice Evra who was good. Well, a lot of people would say who's the better one out of the two. And look, as much as I love Patrice Evra, you cannot knock Ashley Cole's career. From even as a youngster at Arsenal, he was brave. You know, he wasn't afraid to step in at left back. Arsenal have had so many fantastic left backs over the years, your Nigel Winterburns, etc., etc. And he comes in, absolutely zero pressure whatsoever. He's moulded into this fantastic. He was more like a wing back, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was like the first of the modern day fullbacks, really. And was probably the best in his position in the world at the time. You know, there was no one better really than Ashley Cole. You look at that England team and how we didn't manage to win anything or compete even in European or World Cup finals is criminal with the amount of quality we had, really.
Absolutely. Fantastic. Well, Ian, thank you very much for your time, mate.
Thanks, really appreciate it. Before I let you go,
is there anything you'd like to plug? Maybe anything on social media or anything in general?
No, just, as I said, just more plug that, you know, we want to be promoted. We feel it's fair and right thing to do. So the more, you know, help and support we get with that, the better for us, really.
Fantastic. Brilliant. Well, guys, that's it from us. Hope you enjoyed this interview with Ian Everett. Really, really appreciate your time, Ian. Thank you very much. So one more thing before you guys go. Give us a follow on Twitter at @ShootDefence. We also have an Instagram page. So until next time, take care.
Is a hefty responsibility, and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew.
Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.